This is the official EFL podcast with Mark Clement.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the official EFL podcast with me, Mark Clement. In the week when Skybet Championship clubs took an international break breather, in Skybet League One, Lincoln City and Hull City's 100% records took a tumble. And in Skybet League Two, so too did the Salford City manager, Graham Alexander. But the big talking point in football this week has been Project Big Picture, and it will be one of them for us on the official EFL podcast. So EFL chairman Rick Parry, who last weekend broke the news of Project Big Picture to come. But first, just before the return from lockdown, when we finally got to the end of last season, Luton Town sprang a surprise. They reappointed the man who had previously secured their promotion from League Two before departing for Stoke City, just before Luton went up again to the Skybet Championship. 6 points adrift, and despite having lost 22 of their 37 games before Nathan Jones arrived, one defeat in nine saw them survive, and with three wins in four this time around, they are one of the division's early pace setters. Have you surprised yourself, mate?
No, I wouldn't say that. I think we know we've got a good group here. Look, we knew it would be tough after lockdown, but we believed we had to get a good start, which we did, and then we had a lot of games which we felt we needed. Were must-win ones, and we managed to win those ones. And then, we ended up staying up. I mean, in terms of this season, not really, because we've got a little bit of momentum where we believe we're a decent championship side. And look, there's been margins in a lot of games, Tough start away, Barnsley are a good side, and we showed one bit of quality really on the day and got the win. I thought we were excellent at Derby for a long period and deservedly won. And then we went away to Watford after playing Man U, so it was a tough, tough week. But no, look, it hasn't surprised us because we've had a decent start. It's a realistic start. It's not, Utopia would be four wins out of four and stuff. But we've had some tough sides, Derby and Watford are expected to be up there. And then Barnsley and Wigan, have had a similar journey to us. So it's a realistic start.
Do you believe in fit? There are some places that just naturally feel like home.
I do, yeah. But I think we've had to build that. It wasn't initially like that when I first came to Luton and so on. I came in 2016 and you wouldn't have necessarily said it was a great fit. But I think we built something. And then, look, it was slightly elevated in terms of going to Stoke, but a massive learning curve for me. And then I actually came back to a place where I do fit in very, very well. And it is a good fit, but I'm actually better for the experience. So ironically, we're in a far better position than probably when I left.
I mean, this word momentum, is it underestimated in football in so much as it seems to me that when a team gets on a great winning run, it can probably get an extra 5-10% out of its resources just by being in that kind of, push through.
Yeah, look, and I think any side that actually achieves anything has momentum from somewhere, gets it from somewhere, discovers it at a certain point and hopefully doesn't let go of it. We've had a little bit. I mean, to be fair to Graham Jones, they were at decent form going into lockdown. So it kind of started then, really, clean sheets and so on. And then we just carried that on, added a bit to it, which we felt. And then now we've had 5 weeks to work on it through pre-season as well. So we believe that, look, we're a better side. But to be fair to Graham did start a little bit of that momentum. So I can't take entirely all the credit. But the momentum's key in life. It's vital in sport, whether individual or team. And we seem to have a little bit of it. Now, what we want to do is make sure we keep hold of that.
But you have experienced the reverse of it, obviously, this time last year. I mean, what did you learn about yourself during that period? And just how tough is it when you're trying to turn a situation around and that momentum is working against you?
It was weird because I just literally felt at all the time we were in a false position until you actually think, well, we're not, because we haven't won games. But we were actually a decent side, and we would go into games, we'd have good preparation going into games, we would play a certain way, and you just couldn't fathom some of the things that were happening, and you just felt there was a loss of momentum. And in the end, you were just thinking, look, you're not the man to change it, and that's the way it was. I got a great relationship with the people at Stoke, and they gave me enough time, and I should have halted the slide a little bit the last season, but look, I wasn't able to. So I learned a lot. I learned a lot about myself as a human being, especially as a manager. Learned a lot about a coach. And ironically, I'm actually better coming into Luton on the back of a far less successful time than I was leaving on the back of an extremely successful time.
It was World Mental Health Day last weekend. So your message to people then presumably would be that we all have periods of adversity in our lives. We all have periods of challenge, but if you can get through it, then it's a potential benefit going forward. You the big learning curve.
Of course, and it's a massive cliche. You don't really fail, you learn. And, you know, some people just pluck that saying out of nowhere, but it is. And look, I looked at it and I didn't achieve what I wanted to achieve at Stoke. So in definition, yeah, I didn't succeed, so therefore I failed. But I don't think, when I look back on my managerial career, God willing, in many years' time, that will be a thing I look back on as pure failure, because I won't, because I've learned so much from that. And yeah, look, I think a lot of more people were worried about me outside than I was about myself, because it was, you know, it was a tough time. But I'm where my heart must leave. I'm very passionate. So sometimes when you do interviews, it's from the heart. And from, when you go on these LMA courses, and somebody, you shouldn't be like that. You should be same day in, day out, and to come across as a certain way. But I'm a passionate guy. I live my life like that. I coach like that. I drive people on like that. And it was a tough time. But look, I had got good sort of support network. I'm a born-again Christian, which just gives me strength. And it was a massive, massive learning curve. And in the end, it was the right decision for them to make a change. I knew that.
Were you on the floor when the time came, when you that first month when you were out of work? Were you a different character and took some building back up?
No, not at all. And I said, that's what I'd probably come across, as because you're in the public eye straight after a defeat. And a defeat, I couldn't keep making excuses. I couldn't keep putting myself out there all the time and saying, look, it was my fault. I never blamed anyone. I blamed myself constantly. I took the blame. I took the responsibility for every single result, regardless of what happened in the 90 minutes. And I couldn't keep doing that. But no, I wasn't. You know, at the end, it was probably the right decision. It wasn't so much relief. It was like, yeah, this is going to happen now. But ironically, we'd had two wins out of my last four games, two great wins against away at Swansea, home to Fulham. It's just, all we were doing really was papering over the cracks. And what I needed to do was to arrest that momentum. It might have been different, but look, I've learned a lot from it. I did take 2-3 months to reflect and to look back on my time there. And I learned so much. And I said, I did. And I'm grateful for the opportunity. I'm delighted for the opportunity. And as I said, the big thing is I'm actually better now for it.
I love looking back on your whole career. I love the fact that as a player, you went off to Spain when not a lot of lower league players were doing it. I love the fact when you were at Yeovil, you cut your teeth with a women's team down there. Then you went into academy football. And then when a senior role came in your own right, you're in your early 40s, 42, 43. Do you think that was a benefit? That extra 10 years, you developed that little bit more of a, I've got to be careful with my choice of words, a little bit more of an attitude of experience, and that you know there will be highs and lows across what happens to you. Does that make sense as a question?
Yeah, totally. I'm very proud of my journey, my coaching journey, because I knew from an early age, and I've said this well documented, that I knew I weren't going to be a Premier League player, but I tried to cling on to Championship football as much as I could. Then I was probably a top end League One player. That's where I was probably. Yeovil gave me my start in terms of being assistant manager after I'd done my badges with the women. And then I got to a point at Yeovil where I wasn't really learning anything, and I needed to take a step sideways, backwards, or out of that little, you know, Somerset bubble, if you like, to then expose myself to other stuff. And that's when I went to academy football, and that was one of the best years of my life. Learned with Paul Hart and with Chris Powell and good people, and that's when I really, really, you know, learned. And then I went into Brighton and had 3 years as an assistant under three different managers, three different cultures, three different philosophies. They actively educated me to be a manager. They asked me early what I wanted to do. So I had a great learning curve. I was assistant manager. I was a coach. I was an under 21 boss after my own choice. Then I was assistant manager again. Then I was caretaker manager, then assistant manager. So I kind of paid my dues, but at no point did I take a knee-jerk reaction, because I had many opportunities to leave Brighton to be a manager, two, to leave Luton to take other managers' jobs. But I never knee jerk. There's always a real constructive thought process with it. But I'm very proud of my journey, and I think it has equipped me working with good people and experienced people, and that wanting to learn set me in good stead just to be able to handle, because you're never ready to be a manager, but at least you can handle certain things because you've seen other people do it.
Would people be surprised at just what hard work goes in behind the scenes being a manager, and sacrifice as well? I mean, you've got, I can see you on a Zoom link at the moment. You've got your recently born lovely first baby behind you on the wall. You spend a lot of time at that training ground, Nathan.
Look, the sacrifice you have to make, and not only that, obviously my wife, and at the time she was my partner, we had problems in terms of the hours I was spending dedicating my life to the job as an assistant, but also especially when it came to Luton, you know, we had real problems early on. I had to find a balance. We ended up getting a dog and sorting out things with me, actually giving her a little bit back. But look, it's never ending. I mean, managers will tell you that anyway, and I think not as well prepared managers or think it's never ending. But we like to be, you know, absolutely methodical in everything we do. We spend long hours in terms of analysing, in terms of watching. We invest our lives in it, and the lives of our players as well. So look, it's a big thing, and it never ends, because, you know, international break, you switch off, but you're still thinking about the next game, still thinking about what you could be doing. And it's not only sacrifice for yourself and the hard work, it's also, you know, those who are around you have to sacrifice. Because as I said, my wife and my newborn daughter have probably seen my brother-in-law more than they've seen me.
Would you describe yourself as an obsessive, Nathan? I mean, I think it's fair to say that occasionally you do spend more than 24-hour periods at that training ground. That's what I'm hinting at.
Yeah, look, I'm totally obsessive. I have OCD anyway, and I've had that since I was a kid, you know, in terms of everything. If you see my office now, it's everything is symmetrical, everything is OCD, if you like.
Is that positive OCD or is that negative OCD? I guess you see it as a positive. It never drags you down.
No. I see it as a positive. As a kid, it was probably more negative because I had to check so much, and, you know, going to bed at night was a nightmare. But now I see it, and I'm very organized. I have a checklist, a to-do list every day, which I do. I'm always on top of my work, very, very rarely behind. But I see it as a positive because I'm very, very obsessive about my job, about the organization, about how I relate to others as well. And look, I don't demand quite the same standards from everyone, but I do try to set our standards here.
COVID is obviously keeping you apart from big masses of supporters, but as you go about your business, as you nip in the supermarket, as you fill your car up with petrol, are you still having to build those bridges occasionally with Luton fans that are coming across for a chat after going away and coming back?
No, I think we're on an even keel now. I think, you know, some realise that it was an opportunity, some saw it as a betrayal. I saw it as an opportunity that I could have handled far, far better. That's my big regret. But now, you know, in terms of what I've been able to achieve with this football club, I think I've done a good job for them, and they've enhanced my reputation. So the fact that Araki, you know, were humble enough to bring me back, it was a logical move to come back, regardless of all everything around it. It was a logical career move for me and for them. And I think we've kind of repaid each other. But look, I'm very grateful for the second opportunity, because to love your job, since I left school at 16, I've always loved my job, always loved my job, even through tough times. And it became less enjoyable, 2019, you know, it became less enjoyable, but I still had that drive. But now I'm in a place that I couldn't be any happier in personal life, in my job, and it's such a good atmosphere here. And I'm very, very blessed and grateful for that.
Does anything faze you? You don't flinch with some of these questions, and some of these questions are tough.
Look, I've been on a sporadic path, if you like. I didn't have a traditional one where I was a schoolboy up until 16. I got offered an apprenticeship and then pro and then straight into the first team and stuff. I've had to work hard, and I've had to take some big decisions of pay cuts and less contracts and less years just to follow my ambition. And, you know, so I've got good people around me. So at the end of the day, I came from a mining community in Wales. So the fact that I'm managing a championship football club and loving it, it means that something's gone right. And I'm very, very grateful for that. So I enjoy the challenge more than get phased by anything. I would rather, you know, we played Man United, for example. We lose 3-0 to Man United. It was never a 3-0 result. the fact you're up against Man United and testing yourselves, what can be better than that? You know, I could go and test myself against the Dog and Duck and win 10-0, but it doesn't come up against Man United on Sky and so on. And that's why you do it.
Nathan, it's an absolute joy to talk to you. Keep up the great work, mate.
Cheers, Clem. Great to speak to you.
The official EFL podcast with Mark Clint.
Project Big Picture is a plan created by Liverpool and Man United that EFL chairman Rick Parry believes can protect the English football pyramid. The proposals, in case you haven't heard them, are that the Premier League's cut from 20 to 18 clubs, with the three EFL divisions each retaining 24, so the 92 would become 90. The bottom two teams in the Premier League are automatically relegated, with the 16th place joining the Championship playoffs. The League Cup and Community Shield are abolished. Parachute payments are scrapped. A £250 million COVID rescue fund is immediately made available to the EFL, who will take 25% of all future Premier League TV deals. £100 million would be paid to the FA to make up for COVID shortfalls, and nine Premier League clubs would be given special voting rights on certain issues based on their extended runs in the division. Can we do the basics, please, Rick? Who rang who, how you got involved, how much you have been involved? And I guess a lot of people would be saying, why have you been the front person for this so far?
Yeah, I mean, rather than doing the who said what to who, I think it's really important to focus on the benefits, because there's been so much misinformation on the process, which is always a good thing, as opposed to what is the number of this. And, you know, center of this is dead simple. This is about 25% of the Premier League revenues, or the combined revenues of the Premier League and the EFL, because we would assign our rights to the Premier League to market them, 25% of our right of the total TV rights coming to us. That is absolutely transformational for the EFL, for all of our clubs, makes all of our clubs sustainable, narrows the gap between the Championship and the Premier League, the cliff edge, as it's been called, does away with parachute payments, which I've been reasonably vocal on in recent months. So, I mean, if you look back at what I've been saying to everybody who will listen, and a lot of people who don't want to listen in recent months, the challenges facing us long-term are the iniquity of the parachute payments, the gulf between top and bottom, and the fact that our clubs are not sustainable. This actually addresses every single one of those issues, and the critics are doing anything but focus on those issues. So my focus is on the positives, clearly. You know, Oliver Dowden has very helpfully said we should be concentrating on the short term and the emergencies. Which is a, you know, if we had a government that was sorting them out for us and we had some faith in, would be okay. But, you know, we've been looking at this for months and months and months. It predates COVID. It's not a COVID response. This is a response for the next 25 years. It's about resetting the game. So my position is, let's stick to the fundamentals. Let's not get distracted by all of the nonsense, by all the opponents. There are so many positives for the EFL. There are so many positives for the pyramid. You know, that's what we need to be hanging on to. There are powerful vested interests who don't want it to happen. There are controversial aspects to it that have been clearly picked up on, governance changes. But, I mean, those are Premier League issues. They're not our issues. The issues for us essentially are all positives.
Rick, if you had had the financial grant that you want to fill this quarter of a billion gap caused as a result of COVID, would we be having this conversation now?
Absolutely. This is, you know, that is, so part of this, the big picture project, if indeed it does come off, is that we get the 250 million paid up front unconditionally, and it's set against future revenues. So we do solve the short term and the long term. The issue of the discussions with the Premier League over the short term rescue, frankly, had nothing to do with this. This is absolutely about fixing the next 25 years. If it hadn't been for COVID, maybe it would have come out in April. It's been, you know, it's been in the planning for many, many, many months. It has been thought through. We've all got a bit distracted by the short-term issues of COVID, but frankly, for me, there's never a better time for a good idea to come out than as soon as possible.
So can I just be clear? Are the concurrent conversations still going on with government or still going on with the Premier League about the short-term funding regardless of this, Rick? Because a lot of people will be alarmed at some of the headlines that have been going around saying Premier League have cut off ties. You'll be aware Boris Johnson's office said it's this type of backroom dealing that undermines trust in football governance. So there is an implication there that government are not happy with you. Are you still working on a concurrent strategy to bring in this short-term funding to make sure we've still got a lot of our EFL clubs in 4 weeks, 6 weeks, 8 weeks' time?
Yeah, absolutely. That doesn't stop. You know, it also doesn't disguise the fact that those talks have frankly been getting nowhere and have gone on for way too long. But they do continue in parallel. But in terms of the game changer, in terms of the long-term fix, I mean, you could say it's taken me 25 years to get to this point because it is almost 25 years to the day when I was at the Premier League and we did offer the Football League, as it was then known, a share of TV revenues in perpetuity. The deal didn't get through then. And actually what this is about, you know, given the schisms, this is actually about bringing the professional game closer together. It is about the Premier League and the EFL working in tandem. It's about bridging the gap between the two. So again, a bit bizarre, it's all being portrayed as schisms and divisiveness because it's all about trying to create more unity and trying to come up with a plan for the future. And listen, you know, you don't want to knock the opponents, but who else has come up with a plan?
Well, I mean, I'm glad you brought up what happened when you were part of the initial setting up of the Premier League, because it's a really important point that I don't think anybody has brought up. I suppose, would there be any thought that the Premier League might have said, well, we did make you that offer a quarter of a century ago and you didn't take it? I mean, around that time, EFL was obviously doing their own negotiations with On Digital ITV, whatever they eventually became called. But, you know, are the Premier League saying, wait a second, we did offer you this?
No, because they probably aren't a lot of people around at the Premier League who remember that. I think that probably was the attitude for quite a few years afterwards, to be fair. We actually did our best and then we were a bit bemused and a bit surprised that it was turned down because we think it would have been a much better offer. And when you look at the way the numbers have escalated in recent years, it definitely would have been a much better offer. The EFL would have been substantially better off, but this is an even better offer. I mean, it's 25% of the total TV revenues, not just 20% of the domestic revenues. So, you know, it is enormous. It is a game changer. It does make every single one of our clubs sustainable in the future. And you know, let's focus on the positives. Let's focus on our key objectives. Because as I said, we've been absolutely transparent in recent months about the needs and the challenges in the medium and long term, and this addresses all of them.
Rick, are you absolutely confident it is possible to find a solution to maintain the current pyramid in the form as we see it now? You know, one or two, certainly League Two clubs that I've spoken to talk about, will we have to go towards regionalisation? Some have even talked about the possibility of having to make their players semi-professional. Do you think it's possible to sustain four divisions of professional football, four and a half, actually, if we take the National League into account indefinitely?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And you mentioned the National League because, you know, the proposal is not cast in stone. It's the key points, I think, as I said, are immensely strong. There's a lot of detail to be debated. I'm really keen to see how we could impact positively on the National League. You know, if there's this amount of funding flowing downwards, that we should at least consider the debate about the National League, because obviously two of our clubs get relegated to the National League, so we have to care about what happens down beneath us. So I think this will ripple down below the Football League, and it won't be restricted to it won't be just restricted to our section of the pyramid, because at the end of the day, this is all about the pyramid. It's all about, and in fact, you know, the whole thing's got hung up on organisations, who's here, who's there, who's in which league. This is about, you know, this is about the health of the pyramid from top to bottom and all of our clubs. That's where we need a rethink. There's been too much of an us of them, too much of a schism at the top. This is about protecting the entire pyramid. Can we maintain our structure under this proposal? Absolutely. Absolutely we can, because it does make every club sustainable. And, you know, one of the important things League One and League Two have done already is to introduce their own salary caps. So there is restraint being shown on cost. So it's no point in having a proposal like this if it just goes on. Wage inflation doesn't solve the problem at all. But when you introduce measures like this, and, you know, when you look at some of the other detail in terms of funding going for infrastructure, funding going into long-term developments, funding going for the benefit of supporters, this actually is a well thought through package. And yes, can we maintain the league intact? Can we keep every club alive? Absolutely we can.
I mean, I'm going to tread very carefully with this question from both our points of view, because I love the way in which the EFL goes way back to 1888. But you've used the word reset. Have we reached a point where we've rested on our laurels too much? The world has moved on a lot since then. History and tradition is a brilliant asset, but it can also wear you down. Things are not staying the same across the world in many, many fields. Why should football, and why should be one of the bedrocks of football, the originators, be any different?
Because the EFL matters. It's not just about heritage, it's about now. Every one of our clubs has a key place in their communities. We have an extraordinary diversity in the AFL in terms of the nature of the clubs, the nature of the ownership, the size of the clubs. We have the biggest, the smallest. It is an absolute melting pot. It also has an extraordinary authenticity, and the history is part of that. But actually the present is also really relevant in that. So, you know, for me, it's the EFL is worth fighting for, to preserve, not just to preserve, but to strengthen it. And I think any project which actually has a fresh look but says, you know what, we are fighting to preserve the EFL because it's worth preserving. The EFL matters. You look at our aggregate attendances, they're higher than the Premier League's. As I said, we've seen in COVID, in desperate circumstances, highlighted the fantastic work that our clubs do in their communities. When supporters are deprived of the opportunity to go to games, we see how much the clubs matter. So absolutely the EFL matters. And that's not a case of hanging on to the past. This is a case of looking at the present, the future, and saying, yeah, this matters. This is worth fighting for. And the fundamental economic reset is what gives us all hope for the next 25 years.
Where is your biggest blockage to getting this passed, Rick?
Well, listen, it's not in our gift, because clearly the Premier League has to decide. You know, we had calls with all of our clubs yesterday. There was a huge amount of support and enthusiasm, and to be reunited, to be working in tandem again with the Premier League. But it's in their gift. They're the ones who'll have to vote on it. It will, you know, this is going to be challenging. There are winners, there are losers in this. The winner is the game, and I think that's been lost. As I said, there are elements of the proposal that are controversial, that have grabbed the headlines. But is it wrong for us to be focusing on the long term and finding game-changing solutions? Absolutely not. That's exactly what we ought to be doing.
I mean, there'll be people listening to this who, aside from long term, will think, well, you know, my chairman's just come out and said we've probably got 4-6 weeks left before, you know, we might have the plug might have to be pulled. What would you say to them? And what is the likelihood of filling that short-term gap and getting some sort of help for them? Because I'm assuming that Project Big Picture is not something that is going to be signed and sealed in the next month.
No, we will solve the short-term. And this I've been putting quite a lot of time into this, but our whole team at the EFL has been absolutely focused on solving the short term. As I said, the negotiations with the Premier League continue. Negotiations with other people continue. So we haven't taken our eye off the short term ball in any way, shape or form. We will get through this. Absolutely, we'll get through the next few months. The issue is really how bright can we make the long term?
And do you have a provision fund that if an owner came to you and said, that is it, and I've exhausted all possibilities, unless I get some sort of help by 4 days' time, I am going to have to call it a day with this. Have you got that kind of provision in place to help one or two clubs who may be teetering on the brink right this second?
Watch this space. But yes, the answer is we are completely focused on that. And you know, we are looking at different time horizons. Obviously, we're looking at next month, and then we're looking beyond. We continue to negotiate with government. We're not expecting government. Government has made it clear that it's not going to give us substantial amounts of cash, despite its support for other sports, for other industries, for the arts, etc. But they have been consistent in saying there's enough money in football. But we are looking at schemes where government can help us immediately by deferring PAYE, which they did when we first went into lockdown. That's something that could be done again very simply, very straightforwardly, would be an enormous benefit to clubs to get through the next few months. So we're looking at a whole cocktail of measures. But yes, we will get through the next few months. We've absolutely not been deflected or distracted from that. But as I said, the suggestion that it's wrong somehow to be considering the future is, I mean, nonsense, frankly.
Yeah, but I just do need to drill down on this. So anybody that is concerned about the future of their clubs, the half dozen, 10 that might be teetering on the brink now, you don't expect to lose any EFL clubs in the short term. There will be some sort of help and provision there, just to reassure people.
Yes, we don't expect to lose any clubs. And I've said that repeatedly. Do we firmly believe we can come through this season with the clubs intact? Absolutely.
Rick, how do you, I know you've been in the industry for a long, long time now, but how do you deal with the personal criticism and what's your response to your personal critics? You've heard what's been said this week about the relationships you have had in the past, your own personal allegiance, etc. What do you say to those people?
Oh, I love it. Absolutely love it, because it means that, you know, if that's the best the opponents can do, then bring it on. Doesn't bother me in the slightest. You know, let's see their plan. You know, put your plan on the table and then we'll compare it with ours. And if they're not attacking the merits of the plan, if the best they can do is to attack me, then that's great.
I'm talking to you in the middle of October. What would you see as being the agenda over the next 3-4 weeks in relation to Project Big Picture?
I'd probably survive by never making predictions. Never made a false prediction. Listen, I don't know. I suspect it's going to be quite a lively 3-4 weeks, because if nothing else, I think we've had the courage to get out there an issue that's needed to be debated for years and years and years. And it's probably been ignored. The Premier League has got bigger. The Gulf has got bigger. The problems facing the EFL. I mean, look at the challenges facing the Championship. You know, Championship relies on £380 million of owner funding, £16 million a club. I mean, it is the most expensive lottery ticket on the planet to get up into the Premier League. 107% of turnover spent on wages, parachute payments, completely distorting competition. That is a model that's needed fixing for ages. It's not a COVID issue, and it's one we've been looking at for quite a long time. But it should have been fixed 5 years ago, 10 years ago. You know, one of my favourite Chinese proverbs, which I used to see in a hotel when I was in visiting Beijing, was the best time to plant a tree is 100 years ago. The next best time is today. And I think that sums this up. It should have been fixed. It hasn't been fixed. We're trying to fix it now.
Rick, I suspect we'll be chatting to you again on the official EFL podcast. Good luck finding some sort of consensus solution, and good luck plugging those short-term gaps that are so urgent to keeping our beloved pyramid going?
It's not luck. It's application and focus and determination.
Thanks, Wick.
Thank you.
This is the official EFL podcast.
The EFL chairman, Rick Parry, with his thoughts on Project Big Picture. I wonder how much it's been discussed in the dressing room of one of the Sky Bet Championship's biggest clubs. Let's ask the former Wimbledon, Luton Town, West Brom, Aston Villa, Leicester City, Birmingham City, and now Derby County defender Curtis Davis. I had to take a big, deep breath there, mate. And it went round an entire football landscape of the Midlands there for a second. As a top-end championship player, do you feel more aligned with the Premier League, or do you feel more aligned with Leagues 1 and 2 that sit below you and which are part of the cluster of three leagues to which you currently belong?
It's a difficult one. I think when you're at a club like Derby, I guess you're always looking towards the Premier League and you're never really looking down and thinking about League 1 and League 2. You're worrying about trying to get in the Premier League and the riches of the Premier League and what it can do for the club and the players you can sign. So you're always looking that way. But ultimately, I always feel the Premier League's out on their own. The Premier League know they generate all the money. They know that, and even though I say the Premier League, obviously those six clubs probably are the ones that obviously generate most of the money. But it's just one of those things where, you know, the Premier League is out there. It's got that tag of, you know, the playoff final in the Championship is the richest game in football. And until you're in it, then I can't think you can ever say that you sort of lean towards being with them, because ultimately I'm a Championship player. Until you get to the holy grail of be it winning the playoffs or winning the league and getting up there, then you've not got the right to kind of align yourself with them.
You're back in the team and noticeably the end of the 3-match losing streak at the start of the season. Are you taking full credit for this, mate?
If you want to give it to me, I'll happily take it. No problem.
I think a certain former England captain might be taking a little bit of credit as well, because it was a wonderful strike. You know, you'll obviously get lots of questions about him. Does he make a big difference having that sort of single act match winning potential in your ranks, knowing that one moment of magic can change a game in an instant?
I think in a game, on the balance of the way we played and the direction of what we wanted to do with that game, I believe obviously yes. Even though people will talk about, oh, he hasn't got the legs anymore, he can't do this anymore, he can't do that anymore. What he has got is he's got that 1% that 99% of the others don't have. He's got that eye to thread a ball through the lines. He's got the, gets his head up, plays a 6-yard pass without thinking about it. He's got the magical free kicks and that win you games. Especially, you know, we went there to set up and be solid because we conceded too many goals. And we knew that we could play on the counter-attack and maybe nick one. But, you know, as the game was going on, we were settling for a draw. We were quite happy with a draw, a point to stop the rot. And then obviously Wayne, who better, who was literally about to be subbed as well. Luckily, the ball didn't go out. About to be subbed. Jason Knight goes on a massive run. And then obviously Wayne pops up, gets the goal, goes off. See you later, I've done enough. And we see the game out. So when you've got that kind of player in your squad, you have to recognise his strengths. And that's what I'm saying. When you've got that extra inch of quality from him that others haven't got, that's the match-winning level.
Curtis, does the situation need managing as well? I mean, I know you've had nearly a year with him now, but when a player of that kind of reputation drops into a squad, I'm guessing some of the younger ones who've watched him for years are a little bit kind of, wow, how do I act? Does it take a while for the chemistry and dynamic to settle down and everybody to be on the same level?
I don't think it took that long. I think what you will get is you will get people that, you know, at first in training are slightly in awe of him.
That's what I was trying to say.
They're more watching him and kind of wowed by him rather than trying to actually listen. We're training, let's tackle him. Let's tackle him. Let's actually test him and see how good he is and make sure he's good and keep him honest. So I think at first it was a bit, you know, treading on eggshells. Who wants to kick Wayne Rooney, our marquee signing? But after a couple of weeks of being with him, be it a person of my age that played against him, similar age to him, you know, compared to a Max Bird or a Louis Sibley, it all became the same, because Wayne's personality is he's in the change room, he's in the dressing room, and he's a normal lad. So whatever he's done in his career football-wise, whatever he's earned in his career, he came in and he was normal. And that's the biggest compliment I can give him, is that for everything that he's achieved, he's normal in terms of, yes, he'll chat and have a chat with anyone kind of thing, but still has the edge to educate. You know, he'll take Max Bird aside to help him with his game, take a Louis Sibley aside, even a centre-half, and say, if you play like that, then I'm going to get in. But if you do this to me, then you're going to make your game stronger. So it's little snippets of his knowledge that he keeps trying to pass on to people, even older players, myself, others, things that you can maybe do. And that's what he brings, because, you know, at the moment he's a player coach, but he's not the physical coach that's standing there with a whistle and on the side during training. He's the one that, you know, goes into meetings with the coaches, maybe helps on the balance of play from his perspective on the pitch. And then obviously through the little bits through the week, he'll be helping, talking to lads through the week to help them improve their game.
No championship, of course, last weekend with the international break. In League One, Hull City's 100% record ended at Fleetwood Town, and Lincoln City's at home to Bristol Rovers. You know, when you're on those kind of runs, you know, you've won your first four, how much does it play on the players' minds as they run out on the pitch, Curtis, trying to maintain that perfect form?
I think sometimes it's more natural. I think it's not so much the side that you're thinking about it. If anything, you're just steamrolling because you're so confident. You're just stepping into the next game. I think sometimes you're going somewhere and it should be the other team that are thinking about it. So they're overthinking, oh God, they haven't lost a six, they haven't lost a seven. And they're maybe worried about what they're going to do. And then if you get it right, you could literally bounce into another four or five wins. It's just, it's so strange how this league can work, because anyone could beat anyone. But if you get momentum, that's the thing that keeps you just above the rest.
Big win for Ipswich Town at Blackpool, took them top. And after their poor recent form, Portsmouth made it two in a row. And I guess it's a real art as well, and you'll be experiencing it now with Derby. That being what's perceived as a big club in the division, that there is a pressure that comes with that, that you have to be able to assimilate.
There is, because, you know, the big club status is based on your fan base and based on your history. But I think as a player, you need to step back and be realistic. You may be a big club in terms of fan base, in terms of stature, but ultimately you've got to look at where you sit in the table. I think if you're sitting at the top of the table, you've earned the right to be called a big club. You've earned the right to be targeted because of who you are. But if you're sat near the bottom of the table and you're considered a big club because of your fan base, then that's more reason why they're going to be on you. So at the moment, particularly, you know, when you haven't got fans in and things like that, it's a massive equaliser. So if we've got 25, 30,000 at Pride Park singing our names and cheering us on, it's obviously a massive boost. But if you haven't got that, the sides that only maybe get 5,000, 6,000, it's now an equaliser for them, and they've got a massive opportunity to come to our place and try and upset us.
Gilliam in the top six after seeing off Oxford United, and Peterborough United winning the derby match at Northampton Town, actually, where both clubs paid tribute to their former player, Tommy Robson. He died at 76 of motor neurone disease. Played approaching 100 games for Northampton and over 500, wow, for Peterborough. In League Two, Newport County suffered their first defeat of the season at Cambridge. Morecambe made it four wins out of five, actually inflicting a fourth defeat in five on Oldham Athletic. Jamil Matt got a hat-trick as Forest Green Rovers won at Scunthorpe United, and Salford City surrendered a two-goal lead in the last 10 minutes at home to COVID-depleted Tranmere Rovers, which cost Graham Alexander his job. Style is also said to be an issue. I wonder what it would be like to work for the class of 92. How would you not have, Curtis, a sort of inferiority complex when you've got that wealth of football knowledge sort of surrounding you and guiding you every day? That's a challenging job, is it not?
It would be. Listen, if you've got those heads looking over you, and knowing that obviously what's happened with Paul Scholes going into interim charge, that he can just step into the job or one of them can take over and take the reins, it would be a worry. But at the same time, they're football people. So you'd like to think that because they are football people, they should have a little bit more patience with, you know, things like style. I'm quite surprised to hear that, because even though they were all elite players, I see Salford sitting in the playoff positions, which, you know, if you're in fifth in the league and you get sacked, and I understand they've spoken about the manner of the draw against Tranmere, you know, Tranmere were COVID depleted, as you spoke about, and to concede two late goals wasn't good enough. But if a manager puts his team out on the pitch to do a job, sometimes you have to rely on your players as well. And it's unfortunate for him that, you know, it seems that when he did a good job at Scunthorpe, he managed to get the sack at a point where they were in the playoffs. And this job has obviously cost him as well. But I'm sure Graham Alexander will be back, and I'm sure Salford will have a brilliant manager next, whoever it is. But it's just that next manager now is going to have the idea in the back of their head, even if they take the job, that, you know, if I don't do it right, Scholesy can step in, or Phil Neville, or whoever it's going to be, and they can maybe take over the reins.
Yeah, we should pay tribute to Graham Alexander. He got Fleetwood promoted before they moved him on. He took Scunthorpe to the playoffs before they moved him on. And obviously he was the man that brought Salford into the EFL the season before last. Let's do a quick whistle stop around this weekend's fixtures. You have got Watford in the Friday night game. The 200% is Bristol City are at Barnsley, and Reading travel to Middlesbrough. I'm sorry to do this to you, Curtis, but obviously you have seen Reading this season before things got better when you were reselected to the lineup and are taking full credit for the win at Norwich. What about Reading? Are they? I mean, they've surprised a few of us. Their new managerial appointment has surprised a few of us. Do they look as though they're contenders?
They're exciting. They were brilliant to watch. Very organised. But organised in terms of, you know, they'll try and play the ball. If it's not on, they play it into the channels and they let their front four come alive. Their front four is brilliant. Lucas Shaw, what a player. For me, easily one of the best championship strikers. I'm surprised Moore didn't go after him when he was available from Sheffield Wednesday. Always been a difficult opponent, whether he's doing well or not in a game. Because of his stature, how big he is, he's strong. He's got skill. He always gives you a tough game. And the fact that he's gone to Reading and he's got the three around him that are pulling the strings as well, they almost make like a front four diamond and then rely on their two disciplined holding midfielders. But yeah, it's going to be interesting to see whether they run out of steam as the season goes on, because it is costing their front four a lot of energy and they're very reliant on the way their front four are so fluid. But if one of them were to get injured and you had a bit more of a static player on one of the positions, it might cause problems.
Gary Monk, Sheffield Wednesday at his former club, Birmingham City. Obviously, Nathan Jones, we heard from earlier on the official EFL podcast, is Luton Town entertained Stoke. Forrester looking for their first point, and Chris Hughton's first game in charge are at Blackburn. And Wickham ditto needing their first point are at home to Millwall. Into League One, it's first against sixth as Ipswich entertain Accrington. Second place, Lincoln, are at Fleetwood. Third placed Hull, Curtis's former team, obviously, are at Rochdale. Peterborough against Oxford. And I wanted to pick out Gillingham, who are at bottom club MK Dons. Heck of a good 2020 for them so far. One defeat in 17 pre-lockdown. Got off to a good start this time around. Working for a manager with the persona of Steve Evans, Curtis. Would you have to be a certain type of player to be able to accept that level of gruffness?
I think he comes under the Marmite label. I think he's one of those people that if you buy into it, he'll back you all the way, you'll back him all the way, and you can be successful. But I think it can be the other way, that if you're not into it a little bit, then you maybe can fall by the wayside. That's what I've kind of got from, you know, people that have worked with him, people that kind of have worked around him. But ultimately, he's doing a good job. So regardless of who the personnel are, who is buying in, who's not buying in, whether secretly they're not buying in, but they're doing the job, it's working. So whatever preconceptions we have of Steve Evans, he's doing a great job. And listen, if you've got that kind of record through 2020, I'm guessing there's not many records that can match it.
Yeah, damn right. And of course, you know, he's got an absolutely almost peerless promotion record going back a quarter of a century during his time in management, right through from non-leagues to where he is now. In League Two, then, we've got Morecambe at Crawley. I can hardly see my highlights of pen. Hold on a second. In League Two, then, we've got Morecambe at Crawley, Newport at home to Tranmere, Cambridge are at Scunthorpe, Cheltenham are at Southend, and Bolton Oldham, neither doing brilliantly, but North West Derby. So, Curtis, would you see yourself doing a Harry Kewell? Would that be your ultimate ambition? You'd like to sort of get a management opportunity, and you'd be prepared to get your hands dirty if you had to?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's something that the more and more as I get older, like I say, the way I am, my personality, I'm that guy. And I've kind of been told that by the likes of Chris Hughton and Steve Bruce that they can see me doing it and being a manager in the future. But especially being on my coaching course now and you're starting to open your eyes to the structure and all the planning that goes into it and things like that, it is leaning me more that way. But I think the biggest thing for me is I want to play as long as possible. I don't want to hang them up just yet. But with me, I think it's one thing developing players and helping them out as I do with the young players in our squad now. But I like the results-driven side of football, that you can go somewhere and be horrible and win, but you can also go somewhere, play lovely football and lose. I like that side that you have to change your game sometimes to get a result or change your game to see a game out. I like that side of it. So I'm interested to see what happens, but you know, I might be lucky in a few years. If I'm still playing at maybe 38, 39, and I'm at maybe a League Two club, and then if a manager were to get sacked and someone said, oh, do you want to take the reins? You might get lucky. And that's what's happened to a few players. And if that were to happen to me, I'd be buzzing. But ultimately, I'm going to make sure I've got all the qualifications possible. So I'm in a position that if I do want to go along that route, I can.
Don't stop doing this kind of thing, though, because you are excellent at it. Thanks for joining us on the official EFL podcast.
Thanks for having me. Thanks a lot.
That is it for another week. A huge thanks to Curtis Davis, to Rick Parry, and to Nathan Jones. If you've enjoyed this week's episode, then feel free to give us a 5-star rating, press the subscribe button, and spread the word on all your socials. If you want to get in touch, our email address is podcast@efl.com. That's podcast@efl.com. My name's Mark Clement. Thanks very much for listening. We'll see you next week for another episode of
the official EFL podcast.